Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Toward the end of the program, Lou Schreiber is going to be here. He's the director of workforce training at the Santa Fe Community College. Right now, I would like to welcome Amber Gray. She is a trauma intervention specialist. She is the director of Restorative Resources Consulting and Training, and she will, along with Dr. Stephen Porges and Stanley Rosenberg, be teaching a workshop the weekend of January 25th through 27th called Trauma Intervention, an Integrated Approach. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you just got back from Haiti last night. We're very glad to have you on the air this morning. What were you doing there?
I've been working in Haiti for many years, actually, and on this particular trip I was working with a foundation out of Los Angeles who I'm developing a trauma program for called Raven Drum Foundation and integrating their rhythm and drum-based intervention into two programs, one in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and one in Cap-Haïtien, which is the north coast Haiti. Both programs serve children who are either street children, child combatants, former child combatants, kids who've been in gangs. And they have their locally based programs who are providing education and meals and activities for kids who otherwise don't have any kind of stability, live in extraordinarily violent environments. So we're introducing it's basically a drum program for the kids, it was actually a really great week working. They loved it, and it they went really well, and I'll be going back there shortly to continue with the work.
Now, a drum-based program, what is the drumming and the rhythm do for people who are in trouble?
Well, one of the things we're learning from research right now, from neuroscientific and neuropsychiatric research right now in the trauma field, is that there's an extraordinary disorganization, if you will, or dysregulation of our human system, of the nervous system, of the way that the brain functions, and really of the way that our whole body functions. So what ancient cultures have known for...
A dysregulation, under what circumstances?
Well, basically what happens, for example, in a high-stress situation, I'm oversimplifying this, but in a high-stress situation, what happens is that our normal internal activity or internal rhythmicity, the normal groove or beat that we're moving in or walking in or being in shifts. Heart rate accelerates, people start to sweat, and all of that is a function primarily of the nervous system. There's also the brain is the central nervous system, and the brain are involved, and the whole body goes into a more activated or an extreme threat. It goes into a completely collapsed or frozen state. So the internal rhythms or the heart rate, respiratory, things like that are changing. Often, when people are described as being traumatized, what that often means is that due to increased or extreme exposure to stress or to threat, their bodies never come back to balance, is the simplest way to say it. They don't find their beat again. They continue to be extraordinarily reactive to certain things. Somebody walks across wearing a certain color and that reminds them of something, and their heart rate goes up, and then they begin to behave in ways or they didn't previously behave. So one of the ideas, I'm a dance movement therapist amongst other things, and have worked primarily with survivors of torture and war and combat who've been exposed to extreme situations. So one of the things I noticed early on, and one of the things that I started to think about when I first met Stephen Porges, which was in about 2000, is how working with rhythm in a safer, more supportive or playful environment helped people feel better, calm them down, make them feel more playfully alive as opposed to vigilantly alive, things like that. So,
for the moment, or would it last beyond the time that you were actually playing drums and so on?
Well, it could be for the moment at first, but if a person experiences enough of those moments and there's some consistency and repetition in how often those moments occur, and then if a reasonable clinician or therapist makes a link to their everyday life and how they can carry that out, then it can be more long-term. Then there can be a more long-lasting, steady impact. So sometimes I work with movement, but in this particular, because Haiti is a culture where drums are very common, like Cuba, I mean, there's a strong tradition of dance and drum and rhythm, but these kids are so marginalized they don't even have access to their own, what I call their cultural birthright.
Right.
They don't have access to the drums, to the dances, to the ceremonies, to the rituals. So we were working with a drum circle format that, it's a brilliant format that Raven Drum has come up with. And Raven Drum Foundation, they've got a website, but I was adapting and adjusting it to the context of the kids so that it was both technical, some technical drumming, helping them. Hunter Gent, who Elise Gent has been my dance teacher for many years, her son came with me as my program and technical assistant, so he would teach some the kids some rhythms and help keep us, you know, rhythmically together. And then I did a lot of work with facilitating, expressing emotions and different things through using rhythm. So it was, and it was very interesting because several of the kids afterwards said, oh, my, you know, my sadness went away. And of course it doesn't go away forever. They've got to go back to a difficult environment. But they were really enthusiastic about having this become a part of their daily program there. So
I've often wondered if dance and rhythm and music aren't what keep the country of Cuba together, because their challenges are so incredibly strong. I had a teacher who was an older Afro-Cuban man there who was teaching me clave, which is the basic rhythm of Cuban music, and he said, you don't just play clave, you walk clave, you eat clave, you move in clave, and if you get out of clave, you are not living your life.
I've had the same thought about Haiti, and somewhat I've been to Cuba once. And actually, the first time I went to Haiti was to look at the idea of corporal resiliency. I had a question of how can a country of people who've been through so much for hundreds of years, going back to the, you know, the slave trade and the fiery revolution that really hasn't stopped. I mean, there's been just a long-term history of extreme violence. And my question was, is it the dance and the drumming and the rhythm and the connection to traditional spirituality and traditional practices that help maintain some resiliency? And I think it is. And their whole the whole tradition is also a reflection of the traumatic history that they've lived through. So there's a lot of potency. I mean, in working with rhythm, I think with any, really with anybody, they don't have to be traumatized, but especially in a situation like this where, you know, for the kids, it's there's a sense of coming back to something that belongs to them, and I think that's really important.
That which belongs to them, music, dance, rhythm, and so on, do you think that that kind of evolved naturally as a type of trauma healing and as a way of keeping people in balance?
You know, I think of, I know I'm not enough of an anthropologist, so I don't have a broad understanding of these traditions, but you know, one of the things that I say as more and more the field of trauma and science and dance therapy and psychology come around to, you know, we have to include the body in the treatment process and movement and dance, what I hear myself saying a lot is we're beginning to understand through the lens of science what the ancients have always known, which is that there is some profound connection that happens between people when we come together in rhythm, and the early rhythms of the drum and the movements reflected the landscape, the sounds of nature, the sounds around us, the mother's heartbeat. So I think of it as an ancient reflection of rhythm as the organizing principle that connects all people. So
and it's something that's kind of been lost, I would say, in Western culture in the United States and perhaps the northern European countries.
Very much so. Although if you go way north, like I spend a lot of time in Norway, and I've started to work in the far, far, far north, the Sami people have a strong tradition of shamanism and drumming that was silenced by the colonial people. So, yeah, the drums have been silenced many times, and it's interesting because I've often wondered if we were to look at a timeline of, you know, from way back the beginning, whenever that was, to now, of how many places and times where people's traditions that, you know, I'm using the drum silence as a metaphor, but where people could no longer gather as they've gathered, and then the, you know, the occurrence of violence, community violence, wars, disconnect, you know, what happens to people when they get disconnected from one another and from the world around them. So I think, I think rhythm is a really, it'll be a focus of a lot of what we teach at the upcoming weekend, or what I teach.
We're talking to Amber Gray, and there's a workshop coming up called Trauma Intervention, an Integrated Approach. It's January 25th through 27th, and we'll be giving more information out about that toward the end of the show. You work with human rights organizations. You go into places where there have been recent human rights atrocities, and I would think that the political process, which is what is always focused on when you hear the news, could really be hampered by the fact that the people there are, in fact, traumatized. You know, how can you think creatively? How can you be rational? How can you react out of anything besides anger and fright under those circumstances? So what do you do, and what do all these people who descend on a country that has recently gone through a you know, name your problem, what do you do?
What do I do in terms of what do I do to set up a program? That's actually a really interesting question, because one of the things that we sort of joke about, those of us are sometimes rather caustically, but those of us in the field, is often when there is a disaster or crisis, people do flood in. It's like we joked after the tsunami, I mean, not in an unkind way, but there was a whole other flood of humanitarian assistance.
Yeah.
And frankly, what a lot of people do is they go in and they push their agenda. They push their type of treatment, or they push their type of program, or they push whatever it is they think that they know as experts about what will help the community. What I do, quite simply, is I go in and I listen. And I listen to, I work with the people who are there, who are left, to try to help identify the resources that maybe that were in place. Some may still be in place. Some may not. I try to identify what the natural grid work that would have existed for supporting people. I ask them what does this mean to you, and what would you have done? You know, what would you normally do? And a lot of times, people are devastated, and places are devastated. And then I try to work within the local parameters and culture to help people come up with training programs. I mean, I do a lot of training paraprofessionals, because a lot of times, you know, there's a tendency for people to say, well, if you're going to work in a traumatized community, you know, people have to be professional psychologists or whatever, and, you know, you need, and sometimes they're not there. I mean, I've known of two psychiatrists in the 10 years I've been working in Haiti who've been in and out briefly. Two psychiatrists. So it's often
But there's tons of mental health problems.
Right. And there are a lot of people who have really good people skills, who know how to listen, who know how to support. You know, sometimes they're the local ministry, sometimes they're the local traditional healers, sometimes they're the school teachers. And I do a lot of training people in basic skills so that they can provide the support, you know, in an appropriate cultural and social context for the people who are there. I also set programs up.
What kind of skills do you train them in?
Basic listening. You know, so there's a like basic reflective supervision. That's one of the things that's taught in the field of psychology a lot. So it's reflective communication is what I would call it. Empathic listening. You know, I borrow a little bit from anthropology about teaching people to understand their own worldview, and how even though they think they might be listening, their feelings, their thoughts, the way that they see a person or perceive a problem, if they can't put that aside and really listen to a person, they may not connect with the person. Just really basic counseling 101 is probably the best way to describe it. I also
And
do
then
a lot
you go
of,
back and see whether they're doing it or how they're doing it, how they've adapted it?
When I can. I mean, you know, for example, I just did a series of trainings in Khartoum and Darfur, and you know, sometimes I'm funded to do something like that by a particular agency, and I don't know when I'm going to go back. I always make it a, if I can go back, I will. I always try to ask for at least one follow-up trip, or I work with locally. Like in Sudan, I identified some local professionals who were wonderful, and talk to them and spend some time with them, and then they can follow up. I mean, it's truthfully better if it, the more quickly that kind of work gets transferred to the local people, the better, the more success I think there is. So
it must be strange for people who've gone through, whether it be a tsunami or genocide or whatever, to suddenly have all of these people from the United States and Germany, and as you say, coming in. So how do you negotiate those relationships when you first get there? How do they receive you?
Well, it's varying. It's really varying. Like, I remember when I went to Rwanda, I went into Rwanda in 94 after the massacre and the genocide, and it was literally like a turf war. It was like you had to go through all these checkpoints and meet with the local, the military who were trying to keep the country organized. And you had to have meetings with a series of people to get permission to work in a particular part of the country. And it would be like, oh, well, these two NGOs are already there, so you need to go talk to them. And there were literally these turf wars. And it would come to, well, but we do this and you do that, so we're better positioned to create a program. I hated it. I thought, you know, this country doesn't need another war. It needs people. It needs some of us to just come in, do a needs assessment that's not through the lens of what we think we need to bring in ahead of time, but just look at what people's needs are. So I did a needs assessment. I actually spent most of 3 weeks just traveling around and talking to people where I could find them who had survived, or people who were coming back into the country, and then just wrote a program for the organization I was working with. And it was a basic health care program. People needed health centers rebuilt. They needed some doctors to come in. At that time, there wasn't as much emphasis on the mental health aspect of trauma, but I did make a suggestion because there had, I think, one psychiatrist had come in from France or something and was making a bunch of suggestions, which were probably good ones, but not enough for a country that had just been through what it had been through. So I think one of the most important things to go in and do more ethnographic qualitative needs assessments where people actually take time to see what the needs are.
We're talking to Amber Gray. How is it different working with adults and working with children?
Children, by definition, are often a lot more vulnerable. They're also often a lot more resilient. There's a tendency in the field, and there's a lot of people who've been focused for the past 10 years on child trauma. There was a tendency to talk about child resiliency to the point where it almost we would assume maybe that kids had a greater likelihood of bouncing back after something difficult. That's true, and kids are more vulnerable. So as a species, we tend to be the most helpless the longest. It takes us longer to leave our homes.
That's right.
We need
puppies or adults within a year or two.
Right, and snakes, you know, they pop out of the egg and they're gone, or they pop. So we're really, for all our complexity and sophistication, we also take the longest time to grow up. So kids can be really vulnerable. And one of the things that happens is it's very confusing to children when the world around them gets turned upside down. I worked in Kosovo, is actually the proper way to say Kosovo in the Albanian language. I worked there right after the big sweep when the United States bombed. And there were kids, we would go into school, where there were kids who'd lost both their parents, and they were buried in the schoolyard because there was nowhere to bury them. So, you know, these kids, they're extraordinarily vulnerable. And the work is I often talk a lot about the restorative process, and especially with adults who've, if they've had a reasonably good, you know, childhood, and they come from a fairly, you know, well-structured baseline, if you will. I mean, if they were pretty healthy, it's about restoring what you can restore. With kids, sometimes their whole world is shattered. So it's often replacing systems. It's finding, I mean, the therapeutic relationship can be like the caregiving relationship. Kids need to be adopted. They need to find homes again, and it's a lot of times it's really about recreating. I mean, I'm talking about a war zone, but their world again, because everything is gone.
And in a situation like that, are you using movement and drumming and rhythm, or are you doing something else?
Actually, I did use a lot of movement, but I structured it more like games. I used a lot more structure there because literally, I mean, we were working in blown out buildings, and so when the world is chaotic around, I brought a lot of structure, and I often use props, things like yarn or big rubber bands, those big stretchy bands, and we could make circles in. So I created as much structure as possible. I did a lot of work with puppets and drama and things like that so kids could tell their story, you know, in a way that was a little bit more like childhood as opposed to just talking about what had happened, which for a lot of kids was really difficult.
Yeah.
So with kids, it's often, it's longer term.
And as most people know about their own lives, I mean, the tough stuff that happens when you're young can scar you for life.
Mm-hmm. I often say that you know, intensive developmental or childhood trauma, it sets the course and direction of a person's life. And I still always believe that there's tremendous possibility that kids will end up having a meaningful life. I mean, I never give up, because I think, you know, especially with the kids in Haiti who go back, they live in, the kids in Cité Soleil I work with, they live in one of the worst slums in the world. It's violent, it's filthy, it's essentially a landfill that's sitting on the edge of the ocean. And they sleep in corrugated tin, and it stinks, and there's guns everywhere, and there's drugs everywhere. But with kids, if there's enough moments where they have some structure and some opportunity to also play and explore like kids like to do, it's like a thread, I think, that can, if that thread can continue through the course of their childhood, there's still a chance that they're going to end up wanting to do something meaningful. As many of the people who run the programs are people who've come from the streets. You know, they're people who, that's right, why they do this. So,
now, you work with the Center for the Victims of Torture in Minneapolis. How is the trauma of torture survivors different from those of survivors of other kinds of trauma?
Well, actually, I did some consulting to them, for them. So that's more of a... I actually worked at the Rocky Mountain Survivor Center in Denver, okay, for many years. I developed the clinical program there. And as a result, have consulted to a lot of the torture treatment programs, including CBT, around the country. Torture is an extreme type of trauma. And one of the things that makes it extreme is that it's an absolute, it's a power and control. When somebody is being tortured, the perpetrator, the violator, is taking control over that person's every move, every moment, over their body. Even when there's not actually physical torture, psychological torture, it's still extreme dominance. One of the things we've seen clinically, or from the mental health perspective, is people who've, adults for whom we would assume or often know they had a healthy, normal childhood, if they're tortured badly enough, long, for a long enough time, they're, a lot of times the symptoms or the sequela or the result looks a lot like long-term child abuse or childhood trauma, because it's like a complete deconstruction of that person's personality. Good torturers know how to reorganize nervous systems. A lot of torturers, a lot of the Nazis, I mean, a lot of what torturers learned from Nazis, so they actually know how to destroy a person's, what I would call internal rhythmicity, but how to unwire a person's nervous system so that they can never eat normally again, or go to the bathroom, or sleep normally again. So it's pretty extreme. And it's not about interrogation. We often hear that torture is a useful means of interrogation. It's not. It's usually meant to control, to send a message to a community. And the message is, we're in control here. And
if you don't watch out, this is going to happen to you.
Exactly, exactly.
And so is there really, I mean, your whole nervous system is blown out and rewired in a really non-functional way. Is there any chance of putting it back, you know, of healing from torture?
I think so. And again, I've
seen that.
Well, yeah, I've seen people go on to live extraordinarily meaningful lives. And sometimes I've seen people who resume function. They can get out of bed, they can make breakfast, they can go to work. They may never experience the same depth in intimate relationships. They may not be able to have intimate relationships. There's a lot of heartbreak. There's a lot of things that never get set right. But that's why I call it a restorative process. I don't use the word recovery, and this may be a matter of semantics, but there often isn't a full recovery, but it's possible to restore some of what sustained a person before, and then there's also a possibility for innovation, people who can come through, and it's a grueling process. It's a commitment on both a person and a clinician or a therapist or a practitioner's part. You know, when people really work at trying to, and a lot of the work is about restoring the body's equilibrium. A lot of it is about basic psychosocial education. I spend a lot of time teaching survivors what's happening to their body. Once they understand it, they don't think that they're crazy anymore. I do a lot of simple work with breath and heart and spine and things like that. And people, they start to experience moments of calm or normalcy in their body.
Does the rhythm and dance stuff work for people who've had that extreme?
That's actually where I started doing it. It was actually working with groups of survivors, and I still do that. I still travel around, and I work with a group called TASC International. It's T-A-S-S-C. It's the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition. I actually chair the board, but I also have worked with them for many years. And we have a gathering every year in June for the United Nations International Day Against Torture. And I do large group rhythm and drum and movement-based activities. And I've taken those to many places where there are survivors. And it's amazing. It's amazing because there's times where I go, this is crazy. I've not met them. We don't have any established trust. But people respond. You know, I think it reminds people, what people have said to me, what a lot of survivors have said to me is remind me of the things, laughter, joy, play, dance.
Yeah.
I don't need to be reminded of the horror. I'm there all the time.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, it's...
I would think, I mean, there's two different scenarios that come up when you're talking. One of them is a one-on-one therapist and client relationship, and the other is a group relation, group dynamic. And I would think victims of torture in a one-on-one, in a closed room situation might be a little freaked out. And it might be actually safer for them to be in a group.
You know, it goes both ways. Because a lot of times, when I started working with survivors of torture, I actually developed a scale, like an assessment scale, a mental health diagnostic scale. And I was looking at what I call relational and social capacity. Because that's actually can be severely diminished and even destroyed. People don't know how to relate. Because the relationship of a torturer to the tortured is, it's a relationship and it's a very intimate relationship. And people get deeply confused about relationship. A lot of people are terrified to be in social settings. So for some, especially if they come from a culture or a country where group and community-based activity is a norm, yes. And for some, it's terrifying. And then the one-on-one is almost necessary prior to joining a group. One of the things that that we did at RMSC and CBT in Minneapolis does it as well, and I'm now working with the state of New Mexico to develop refugee mental health. We've got more refugees coming in. The treatment environment, like we often worked in Denver, we worked out of an old house. And my quote-unquote treatment room looks like a comfortable living room. And a survivor always gets to choose. They can move the chair. They can rearrange the furniture if they want. If they want to, most often they want to look at the door. They can open windows. The windows may be open and closed 20 times during a session. That's okay. There's flowers, there's always water available, things like that. So you're absolutely right. And it requires an attention to the detail of the environment and the surroundings. And Stephen Porges, that's one of the things he talks about is, as a result of his, incredible research for many years, is the need for a safe environment to even begin to talk about a restorative or a healing process.
We've talked about people who are from war zones and victims of political torture and natural disasters and so on. What about people here in the United States in regular civil society? I would think that there's all sorts of subgroups of highly traumatized people and perhaps borderline tortured people, too, like battered women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, absolutely. And there's a lot of... there's a lot of similarities between survivors of domestic violence, women who are battered, women who are raped. In the torture treatment movement, we use the term political torture to differentiate that people are tortured for political reasons, but that doesn't mean that a survivor of domestic violence, it's just as intense, it's just as awful, because it's an ongoing sense of captivity. It's an ongoing sense of being under the control of somebody else. So there's... sadly, I think there are groups of people who are exposed to violence and stress and trauma everywhere. And I don't, there's that question of, is it increasing or do we just know more because media is more, can take us to more places now? I don't know, but I think you're right.
Do you work with those groups here in the United States?
I don't as much. I've worked with... I have a very small private practice, and it's only because I travel so much. I really can't support a private practice. And I have worked with, in the past, I've worked with women who are trafficked and become victims of domestic violence, ritual abuse, things like that, cult abuse. So I've worked with various. But my focus has been on war and torture. There's actually not a lot of people who want to do it.
How did you get into this work? I can't imagine wanting to do that.
I don't have a great response because it's I'm going to quote one of my colleagues from Chicago, Mary Fabry, Dr. Mary Fabry. She's at the torture treatment program there, and she talks about the first time she was working in a hospital setting, and she encountered a survivor of torture and worked with her psychologically. And as she said, it's like having my eyes open and they can never close again.
Yeah.
I saw somebody being tortured in Nepal in the 80s. I woke up in the middle of the night to this awful screaming, and then I ended up working in war zones in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in various places. So I don't know why I ended up in those places, but it's the same principle. Once I've seen it, I can't forget it, and that just became that's what I'm passionate about.
We're talking to Amber Gray, and she's a trauma intervention specialist, and she will be teaching a workshop along with Dr. Stephen Porges and Stanley Rosenberg the weekend of January 25th through 27th. And we'll give more information about that in just a few minutes. Working within the mental health care systems and the medical system, the various non-governmental organizations and political organizations and so on, there's likely to be large numbers of rules and regulations and guidelines, and then above all, the imperative to measure outcomes. I was reading something in preparing for our conversation today, and I thought, first of all, that kind of thing could drive you crazy, but also, how do you measure outcomes?
Mm-hmm. That's another really good question. There's a movement now towards measurable outcomes and evidence-based practice, and it's all really good and important because that's a way of finding out whether or not what we're doing works and helps people. And there's the multidimensionality of the human experience, and the fact that my work is so cross-cultural that I don't, in terms of measuring outcomes, I don't ever like to assume that a really solid depression measure like the Hopkins or the Beck really has any relevancy to a culture outside of our own sort
the
of
Hopkins
Euro.
The Hopkins or the Beck, what are those?
The Beck Depression Inventory or the Hopkins. I mean, I'm just giving an example of these are how you would measure outcomes. If somebody scores for clinical depression and then after 6 months of treatment their scores improve, I mean, that's an outcome measure. But a lot of these are created in the context of European, Eurocentric Western culture.
Yeah.
One of the ways is there's a brilliant physician who I've been very fortunate to work with, Dr. Paul Bolton. He's at Johns Hopkins, and he's developed a qualitative assessment process. We did one in Haiti, and we've worked together in Mexico, and I'm actually hoping he'll come out here at some point. But it's a way of going into communities affected by violence or war, asking them how they describe their problems, and literally sifting through research, it's qualitative research, and coming up with variables that are meaningful in their context. They might be local idioms or terms, and then coming up with a quantitative measure that can be used in the implementation of any programs or interventions to see if the outcomes, to see if there's improvement or people get better. So that's an outcome measure, but those outcomes could be looking at something like, I can't think of a word, but there's a expression in Creole, que fait mal, which means it's a heart that is gone very bad. But it's not just a broken heart. It's a heart that has so much grief, it's full of pain.
Yeah.
So is it depression? I mean, but it's a really interesting question. And, of course, within the United States, a lot of people are doing really good evidence-based work. And the outcomes that they look at, like if there's improvement in academic performance or concentration or a decrease in depression, have meaning because it's a fairly, while we're a fairly diverse culture, there's also a certain homogeneity to Western culture. But when you start to talk about evidence-based and outcome measures and all the results, that's one of the things that drives some of us who run programs internationally crazy, is we're reporting to a donor in D.C. or Geneva, and we're working in a tribal community in Africa, and
right.
It's like where's the relevancy to what they want? And it's not a right or wrong. It's just how do you find the meaning? I mean, how do you make translate something so that it's meaningful in a local culture? It's a big debate, actually. It's a big.
I often wish that when the Western people are imposing their measures and standards on others, If the tables could just be turned on them for one day. In other words, whether the person sitting in the office in Geneva or Washington would have to learn how to play clave or how to play play the drum for a day and stay on rhythm for a solid hour.
Oh, yeah. I often think that everybody should be required to spend... Sometimes it depends upon what state I'm in. It might be 2 weeks or it might be 2 years. But, you know, all of us... What an opportunity to be able to go someplace else and just literally walk in somebody else's shoes. And I agree. It's a natural tendency to stay in our cocoons and to stay comfortable and to do what we know. But
then try to impose that on other people.
Right. And that's one of the things that I talk a lot about when I teach is a non-colonial approach to intervention. And not everybody likes it when I say things like that. But that's really what I'm... promoting is that we go in and we not, we might find post-traumatic stress disorder in a community and we might not, just because I remember going to Indonesia after the tsunami and everyone was like, oh, everyone's going to be traumatized. And I didn't diagnose a lot of people, but if I was put on my clinical cap and was looking through a lens, it wasn't trauma. It wasn't the classic PTSD. There was a lot of grief and loss, but people had such a spiritual grasp on what had happened. Their culture and their religion provided them with an understanding that I didn't have.
Very interesting.
That collective post-traumatic stress, I don't think so. And yet a lot of people were coming in and asking 5 questions, yes or no. Oh, if you have this, you have PTSD. We better send some experts in. And, you know, it's...
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It makes one want to write a sort of satirical comedy about the whole,
that would be
the whole intervention game. I wanted to ask you this, how do you keep yourself sane and healthy? I would think that even though you know, maybe you haven't suffered anything like the trauma of the people you work with, or maybe you have, I don't know, but you're exposed to so much. On some level, I think it would be hard, and you'd have to keep yourself. Do you use your own methods on yourself?
Mm-hmm. Well, I dance. I mean, one of the reasons we moved to Santa Fe is so that I could dance at the Rail Yard. I danced there. The first time I ever danced with Elise Gent was like 20 years ago, and I just think it's one of the best dance classes and best communities, and I always have to live somewhere where I can dance and where I don't have to be facilitating or leading the dance, where I can go to a class. When I was living in Haiti, I lived in Haiti 2004 during when Aristide was removed and there was tremendous violence. I danced. I danced with a local dance troupe, and I took some classes with them, and they invited me to dance with them, and that was my sanity. I'm a continuum movement teacher, and I often practice that. I sometimes carry little DVDs around of, you know, gyrotonics or whatever it is that I want to do, and I do it in my house. I also spend as much time as I can. It's not always possible in some places. Haiti, we were in lockdown a lot of the time in 2004. Darfur, we couldn't go out, but if I can get out and take a walk, I find just being in nature, I really respond. You know, I take a lot of camping trips in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I do things specifically to turn all of that off, and I've become much better when somebody says, oh, tell me about what you do if it's a Saturday and I'm, you know, camping up near Taos or something. It's like, no, I don't want to talk about what I do. I just want to camp right now. So a lot of it is just practicing the things that I love.
Tell us about the upcoming workshop. It's January 25th through 27th. It's called Trauma Intervention, an Integrated Approach. And I just have to read the subtitle of that. The Polyvagal Theory, Social Engagement and the Restorative Process. There's a word I'd never heard.
Which
and I still
one?
Don't know what it means. Polyvagal.
Polyvagal Theory and Social Engagement System are Stephen Porges' work. And he's going to talk about that. And he can talk about it much better than I can. But the Polyvagal Theory comes from his very intensive research of the central nervous system and his understanding for a long time the human stress response or response to threat was often described in terms of an autonomic nervous system response, sympathetic, parasympathetic, and he's found in human beings a much more complex parasympathetic, autonomic nervous system, specifically parasympathetic. And it's polyvagal because there are two branches, if you will, the ventral vagal and the dorsal vagal. And the ventral vagal is a result of evolution. It's quite uniquely human or found in more advanced species, and it has a lot to do with social engagement. And I was captivated when I first heard him speak because I was thinking about social and relational capacity in survivors of torture as a clinician. And when he talked about, I mean, in a very overly simplified nutshell, he talked about the need for restoring safe environment and relationship. And I was working with people whose sense of relationship was so shattered, their own bodies were literally minefields of pain and suffering, that there was no safety in the world. I thought, huh, you know, I asked him some questions actually at a lecture, and then I started reading his work, and he's mentored me, and now we're beginning to teach together, and that's his work. But he's, you know, he can describe it in terms of all sorts of internal rhythms and arrhythmias and sinus and this and that. I mean,
right.
You know, big technical terms. But it's really how the human nervous system supports us to stay in relationship. And if the environment is safe enough, and it's what happens to it if our sense of safety is diminished. That's what he talks about.
Who is encouraged to take this? Is this for people who are psychologists and healers?
I would say mental health, body workers. We're doing something a little bit bold here, and there's been moments of, you know, is this too bold? Because Stanley is a body worker. He studied Rolfing and cranial sacral, and he's teaches something he calls a social engagement protocol, and he works directly with the nerves. Stephen Porges talks a lot about the cranial nerves, the 5 primary cranial nerves that are involved in the social engagement system, which I left out before. So it isn't just the autonomic. But he, as a hands-on person, he can work directly with them. As many of our teachers here do, I actually used to be a body worker, and so I've studied with... We have some people here who do some incredible work. So body workers, it's a great workshop for body workers. I'm going to bring in, despite my body work background, I'm going to be focusing on the mental health perspective. I've done a lot of individual work. Now I do mostly community-based and group work. And it'll be a lot of learning through the group experience for mental health about the application of Stephen Porges' work through using rhythm and working with some simple internal rhythmicity, maybe doing some work with breath. And I would say anybody, yeah, in the healing professions or helping professions, doctors, acupuncturists, nurses, movement artists, it's bold. But part of what we're saying, actually a big part of what we're saying, because we live in a country that's very regulated. If you're a psychologist, you don't touch people. If you're
right.
a massage therapist, you don't touch emotions. And there's really good reasons for those limitations on our professions, because we all need to have the right skills to do the work that we're doing. And when we're dealing with human beings, we're dealing with a whole person and a whole range of experience. So I believe strongly in teamwork. And I've done a lot of work where I'm the clinician and I take my client, we go together to a bodywork session, and I'm there when they receive the work.
Interesting.
I think it's trickier for people to combine it. So what we're really promoting here is that we learn from one another. You know, those who work with the body is kind of the foundation of this course because, again, mental health professionals are starting to get much more interested in somatic work or creative arts work, things that integrate the body more. And body work is already doing it, but without the training or the licensure to work more in the emotional realm. So it's really an opportunity to learn and to think about a broader picture.
And if people want more information on that, they can call the toll-free number 866-505-2006. The workshop is January 25th through 27th right here in Santa Fe. And they can also go to ShearerInstitute.com. And Shearer is spelled S-C-H-E-R-E-R. So ShearerInstitute.com. Amber Gray, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Amber Gray is a trauma intervention specialist and director of restorative resources, counseling, and training. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. We're going to take a very brief break right now. We'll be right back. I'd like now to welcome Lou Schreiber. He is the director of workforce training at Santa Fe Community College. Welcome.
Good morning.
So the semester is just getting underway, is that right?
Yeah, next week.
And so people can register for classes right now, and we often do this at the beginning of the semester, talk about some of the interesting stuff that's coming up. What is new in the areas that you do? I mean, workforce training is a big thing, but you've got a Going Green initiative.
Yeah, that's the big thing I'm focused on. We have two parts to it. We have credit stuff happening, new credit courses, and non-credit courses. So let me explain. We have a certificate in environmental technologies that's in its second semester, second time round. And we're offering a course in instrumentation, and a course in introduction to water conservation technologies, and a course in sustainability and environmental ethics. And those three courses are part of a certificate that started last semester and will finish in the following semester. We're getting good response. We have a nice cohort of people that are interested in it. And this is designed to give people a general overview and some basic skills so that they can move into a variety of different jobs and businesses in the environmental green field.
Now, is a certificate valuable? I mean, do people recognize a green...
To some extent. It's an entry-level document, right? So you go to apply for a job, and you show that you've taken six or eight courses and that it's been in a form of a certificate, it has some credibility. It's not a bachelor's degree. It's not a master's degree, but it's a step in the right direction.
What do people actually learn? What are some of the actual topics?
Well, as I said, water conservation. So a full range of understanding about how water is moved around the state of New Mexico and then how to conserve it on a home basis, on a residential basis, and on a commercial basis. We had a course in electricity and mechanics, so people understand now how a solar system works, how a solar hot water system works. We had a course that was an introduction to environmental technologies or alternative energy technologies. Again, so people learned what's out there, all the different technologies, how they work, how they interface, what the challenges are, what the future is in each one, what the job opportunities are in each one. So we're this little...
And then environmental ethics.
Yeah, environmental ethics. Well, we have to look at that, don't we? I mean, we have a breach in environmental ethics for the last X amount of years, and now it's come out that this global warming issue has brought that to the fore. So we're going to look at sustainability and how we develop a base of environmental ethics that we can move forward with. Then on the other side of the table, if you will, is this non-credit program that I've developed called the Center for Community Sustainability. And these are courses in a variety of different areas, but this semester all focused on building and green building. So we have earthen plasters and earthen floor intensive for people who really want to get in on the mud and learn how to use those get their hands dirty and use these old techniques in new, interesting ways. We have an Eco Harmony for a healthy environment for people who have or want to learn more about environmental sensitivities and the kinds of products they can use or not use to achieve interior environments that are healthy. The really exciting ones that I'm most jazzed about is there are two, green building for builders and green building for homeowners. So a green builder here in town named Ferran Dancer, who's really on the top of the game in terms of green building, has developed these two courses. So we want to encourage builders out there. Hello, builders. Are you listening? This is a great opportunity to really learn all the nuts and bolts of green building and fit your approach to building into this wave of green building. And on the other hand, we want homeowners or potential homeowners to understand the parameters of green building so they can make choices about where they're going to invest their money, who they want to work for them in terms of realizing a green building project. And so this class goes called Riding the Wave Green Building for Homeowners series. Then we have another long series which looks at all the aspects of building. So, and then at the end of the semester, we have a solar energy certificate. And we've been doing that for years. We put up a solar system at the college last spring with a group of students who learned in the classroom for a couple of days and then spent 3 days out building this solar system. So we're going to do that again, and we're working on a project to put up solar panels at Santa Fe Prep. as part of this class, kind of a collaboration. Someone donated the solar panels. We're going to get the students to go over there and put up the panels.
And involve the Santa Fe Prep students
and
in learning
as
what's going
well,
on.
As well. And we've got another project in the oven, so to speak, with Monte del Sol. And the last project, well, not last, it's never going to end this, but the last thing that I'm working on, or one of the interesting things I'm working on now, hopefully, will be a wind turbine project this summer that we will purchase, the college will purchase and install a wind turbine, and students will do the installation so that, again, there's this ability to understand and work in this field. Nambe Pueblo is looking at a 99 wind turbine wind farm. They're in the early stages of developing it, so we think it's time for us to train people. It's all about training. It's all about raising general consciousness about these environmental and building issues, and then training people to work in various fields.
Lou Schreiber, if people are interested in this, how can they find out more and sign up and take the steps towards signing up?
Well, it's all on the website. It's all on www.sfccnm.edu.
That stands for Santa Fe Community College, New Mexico.
Dot.
Not to be confused with the one in Florida.
Right, exactly. Or they can call me, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody about any of this stuff. And my number is 428-1617. And so folks are just welcome to call me and I can explain. I met with a lady yesterday, for example, who is looking to re-career from what she's doing now and add this whole aspect. And so I can talk to people gladly.
Lou Schreiber is the Director of Workforce Training at Santa Fe Community College. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks for Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista, baby.